Good morning. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, it's kind of cold and drizzly.
It wasn't this weekend, though. It's beautiful.
No, it was wonderful. Hey, I want to tell people this is KBOO, 90.7 the FM dial, and you're Abe Proctor, I'm Joe Uris, and this is Talk Radio.
Yep.
And we're going to talk.
We are. We don't like Bush on this show.
No.
No, we don't.
Why is that?
How long do you want me to go on?
He's so cute. He's so cute. He has a little strut around, little kind of cock of the walk thing going on, you know?
Right, right.
He's cute.
Yeah, and
Bush
that,
cute.
That codpiece he wore on the aircraft carrier.
Oh, man.
Man, that's the kind of president you want.
What about the hump he wore during the debate?
I thought that was his natural.
No, no, that was a special.
Oh, you mean
thing.
The wire?
Yeah, the wire. Oh, yeah, and nobody called him out on it. The Democrats are such cowards. Ooh. Okay, never mind. Oh, we got a lot to talk about. Right. We're gonna start out by talking about the parade.
Yeah, it turns out we're not the only ones who don't like Bush.
Ah, isn't that surprising?
There are thousands and thousands of others.
I thought it was interesting how the numbers were counted. The police said 9,000 or 10,000, and the Oregonian said 9,000 or 8,000, 8,000 or 9,000. They measured by some scientific stuff that they did through mystical processes, kind of contradiction.
Well, aerial photography.
Yeah, well, no, you're looking out the window. their best technique. And then you know, and I tried to count but gave up after 10,000.
Oh, he sat there and counted to 10,000?
No, I'm lying.
All right.
But, you know, it was a big parade.
And organizers estimated what?
Oh, I don't know. They exaggerated. You know, they said 100 million. You know,
well, so. That always happens.
Yeah.
Police always aim low. The organizers
well,
aim low.
A lot of police were kind of rude, actually. I had some weird experiences.
Did you?
Yeah. I was surprised because they behaved well.
I thought most of the time the police that I saw were behaving
well. I started a discussion on the way down there on the MAX, actually, because the crowd was kind of, you know, they were really packed in, very intimate relationships going on the MAX among strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started a conversation with some people there. And it was interesting. We were talking about what do you do when the government's unresponsive and does it make any difference? And we discussed the concept of the tipping point, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you never know when that is, which is true, folks out there. In a struggle, you never know the point when it's changing. And this might be it, might not be it. But the tipping point is a very important thing, which is why you have to keep on. Don't be stupid, though, but be smart in your struggle. But anyway, we're talking about that, and one guy on the train, who African-American guy, who everybody was sort of kind of assuming he was somewhere else in his head or something. But he chimed in, and he gave a very abstract analysis about the problems of revolution and what happens when, you know, when things are in flux and who ends up in control and so on. So he's kind of an interesting guy. And he and I sort of hung out together when we got off the train, and we were walking, and I told him I was doing stuff for KBOO and stuff, and he couldn't understand. First of all, he said, well, you got a card, and I said, I don't have cards. He thought that was stupid. And then, and he's probably right. And then he said, well, give me your pencil. I want to write down the station number so I can call. And I said, I didn't have a pencil or pen. And he said, what kind of reporter are you? You know, he's right.
But That's a very good question.
That's a good question. But I have a good memory. And then we came to these bicycle cops. And he said, well, they would have a pencil or pen, wouldn't they? And I said, oh, they got to have that so they can write us up or something, you know. So we went over to them, and he asked one of the policemen if he could borrow a pencil or pen so he could, you know, he could borrow a pencil or pen. And the policeman said, and I'm not making this up, what for? So I said, to write with.
He must have been one of those writers.
I don't know. So I said, to write with. And then one of the other policemen loaned us a pen. But it was weird. It was kind of a weird encounter. And then all through the thing, I kept asking policemen, just for the help, how many people do you think are here? And they all said 2,000.
Really?
Yeah. It was some kind of number they decided on in their secret conclave.
Didn't make him feel better, I guess?
I have no idea what's going on there.
But I have to
say, they were very nice.
They were. Most the I didn't see, the only time I saw marchers and policemen squaring off, as it were, was on West Burnside.
Oh, the Black Block.
There was a knot of Black Block protesters that were hemmed in by cops on bicycles.
Yeah.
And the Black Blockers were saying that they were being unfairly singled out because of the way they were dressed.
No, it was the way they were acting.
That's what they were saying.
I saw them. They were rude. They would come up to a group of kind of like Christian pacifists, mm-hmm. you know, who were, you know, saying kind of pacifistic slogans mildly, loudly, and then they would drown them out with some kind of vicious attack on whatever. And I thought that was just rude. I thought they should form their own little unit and do their own thing if they want to do that. But I even go further than that. I now believe that the Black Bloc needs to consider having its own demos. Hey, they're on a different trip. It's okay.
Yeah,
it's a different trip.
A different trip.
It's really a different trip. And you know, and I didn't like their kind of rude sign attacking the troops in Iraq.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand the purpose there. So if anybody out there is a member of the Black Bloc and can explain that sign, please do give us a call.
Yeah, it had the F word in it.
It did.
F the troops.
F the troops. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We'd like to hear from you if you're at Sunday's demonstration, hear about your impressions, what you thought of the speakers, what you thought of the turnout, and what your favorite sign was.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw a replica of an ICBM.
Yes.
Painted red, white, and blue, and written on it was George's boner.
Ooh.
I thought that was pretty good.
Here's some things that really moved me. Toward the end of the parade, it was very long. I call it a parade. It's not even a demonstration. It's a parade. It's a manifestation, as the French say. A manifestation. I saw the Bread and Puppet Theater out of Vermont. You know.
Yeah, the guys in orange?
No. I'm coming to them. That's a different thing.
Okay.
But the Bread and Puppet people had, at the beginning, they had a guy, African-American guy, tossing a flag.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful flag, and doing a very good job of that. And they had a drum, kind of a little mini drum corps, and some people who may have been associated with them on unicycles in white. And then there was a line of puppet head wearing figures in burkas, white, kind of off white burkas, carrying what appeared to be mangled dead children.
Oh,
just a line of them. And then the last one had little finger symbols. And then behind them were a straight line, this the long line going, you know, with the crowd, and then a line across the crowd march of figures in men's black suits with black hats, with white faces, white masks, with just mouths. And then they would periodically, this big symbol would crash, and then the group would change slightly, and suddenly these figures would raise their hands, which were white gloves covered with blood, and they would do a kind of Greek chorus, moan.
Wow, how did I miss that? I must have been at the wrong part in the parade.
And that was, yeah, you missed that, man. And it was, see, I cheat. I just watched the parade.
Oh, you
know, I like to see all the things. And they were so powerful. Seriously, so powerful, so capturing the tragedy of the whole war, with these lines intersecting, and it's very, very, very moving. And then on the fun side, there was the March 4th marching band,
yeah,
who were in crazy, you know, outfits and so on. And I really liked them.
Yeah, I liked them.
There were a lot of groups. Then, as you mentioned, there were the people in orange with black hoods.
Yeah, the orange prison. Yeah, the orange prison jumpsuits with the black hoods, a la Abu Ghraib.
Yeah,
all chained together in various torture poses in the middle of the street.
Yeah, I thought maybe they'd get naked and form a pyramid, but no.
No, that was at the after party.
Ah,
but those guys are pretty impressive too, and were drawing quite a knot of bystanders.
Yeah, and then
we're watching it.
There was some odd things. There was a lady over by the Starbucks on where the Max crosses Broadway there, and this lady was angry. She was very upset, and these two older women. She was probably in her middle to late years, and they were quite old. And she suddenly was arguing with them about how can you be so disrespectful to the president and George Bush and so on. And then it turned out it took on a religious tinge. And suddenly she attacked this quite old woman, saying, "You better be careful with your thing, because you're old and you're gonna die soon and meet God."
Hmm.
And people had been listening to the argument, and the discourse had been kind of ugly but not bad. But at that point, everyone turned against the attacking woman. You know, it was so interestingly rude. Hmm. But she'd run out of argument, I think, so she attacked the other woman for being older than her.
Well, if she knows what's going to happen to that woman after she dies, boy, she's you know, got an advantage on the rest of us.
Well, definitely, she probably from God's mouth to her ear. Anyway, I thought that it was a really nice event. Lots and lots of people of all ages, and all persuasions.
Yeah, I brought my son with me.
How'd that go?
Oh, it was great, man. He walked the whole way. He was really jazzed. He's 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a talk about the First Amendment and the right to peaceable assembly and. Yeah, it was a really good time. I was happy to have him along.
Well, that's you see, that's it. You're training the youth in subversive activity.
That's right. I am.
Good
for proud of it.
Too. Good for you.
Yeah. And the speakers, I thought, by and large, were pretty good. I thought the Reverend Leroy Haynes was extraordinary.
He was great, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was.
Wasn't he? And the
wonderful
act was good,
style.
But she was very emotional.
Yes,
but she was good. But and in general, the speakers were quite good, though I think everyone is kind of meeting friends and stuff. It's sort of a problem at the beginning of these things to get people's attention.
Yeah.
Charismatic, he was, Leroy was certainly charismatic enough, but somehow it doesn't quite come together on the speaker thing, and I have no solution to that. My only criticism is I didn't see a lot of postering and chalking prior to the demo, and I walked by on Saturday, I walked by a Millennium Music on Burnside, mm-hmm. and several other hip spots on Hawthorne, and they didn't have any posters up, and in Millennium, people didn't even know the thing was happening. So there's still, even though it's a huge crowd, there's still a lot to go in publicity. And I want to compliment the people who did it. It was a great job.
Yeah, it was.
But there's still, all of us have to take responsibility to reach out more, therefore. Because that's a hard thing to do something like that.
Yeah.
But, hey, praise on them all. It was great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I felt much better afterward.
I did.
See, it's an affirmation, and it's very influential. And what's interesting, the indication that the tide may be turning, that tipping point may be there. The Argonian featured it on the front page on Saturday as a preview. You know, they mm-hmm. put that as their front page story. Maybe nothing bled, so nothing led. But, you know, they did that. And then they treated it with dignity and put it on the front page again on
Monday?
Monday.
Yeah, and they had an aerial photo on the front page of the Argonian of the march. And so I was curious, you know, about how the local media were going to cover this, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not it would make the local TV news, which it did.
Oh, yeah, it led,
yes. And so I looked on the Oregonian's website yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and their lead photo mm-hmm. was a bunch of protesters burning American flags.
There was that toward the end. Somebody did that.
There was that
part of
the
Black
end,
Bloc
yeah.
thing.
So, I mean, I should have known that the Oregonian couldn't resist, you know, putting that picture first on their website.
Well,
they weren't going to, you know, they weren't going to jump in with both feet. As it were.
No, they're a little careful. But yeah. It's, you can sense, they can smell the disillusionment of even the most supportive of Bush's buddies.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to deny reality constantly for, what, 3 years going on four now?
Yeah.
This is the fourth year?
This the contrast I noticed between this march and the last big one, which, of course, was on the eve of the war 3 years ago,
uh-huh.
when Blumenauer spoke and John Lewis from Georgia spoke.
Right.
And there was
Blumenauer was at the march, though.
He was.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, good for him.
Or at least I was told that. I don't want to be a bad reporter. I was told he was at the march.
But at that march, there were an awful lot of war supporters lining the parade route
right.
and heckling the marchers.
Not this time.
And I saw just a solitary protester, or a war supporter.
There. Yeah, and then there was another guy about the abortion issue.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that.
Totally right. irrelevant.
Right, totally irrelevant.
So, but I also have to say that, speaking of local politicians, you know, one measure, we're going to have, on the 18th of April, we're going to have, as you know, all the candidates, the three candidates for county chair,
mm-hmm.
Multnomah County chair, very important race, and we're going to have all three of them in a kind of a debate situation here. They've all cooperated, and there's a third candidate people don't know, last name Smith, as in S-M-Y-T-H, but all three will be treated equally, because that's KBOO's way.
Right.
And I don't know if Wheeler, you know, he's the big contestant against Diane Lynn for that chairship. I don't know if he was at the demo, but Diane Lynn was there very prominently. I have to say that.
Oh, really?
I have to say that because it's true. Now, if Wheeler was there, I need to know that. Someone should call me and tell me. And the same for Smith. And I also have to say that one of the questions I think we're going to have to ask these candidates, these three candidates in this nonpartisan race, is actually what is their political backgrounds? Don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's relevant.
I think that's very relevant.
Yeah,
because you know,
say what,
county
we don't
commission.
Say what party do you belong to? But you know.
Well, I know. I think we can ask them what party they belong to. Why not? What the
because
hell?
That's these days, it's not much of an indicator.
Well, it is.
Unless
no,
you're a Republican.
No, I don't agree. Republicanness is an indicator.
Yes.
Okay. And ambition. Ambition is indicated by party membership, too.
Yeah, but see, saying you're a Democrat these days doesn't even mean that you're a vertebrate.
Excuse me?
Doesn't even mean that you actually have a spine.
No, I heard what you said. I just okay. So we're going to have this debate on the 18th, and all of the next few weeks, everyone's going to give us lots of money. And this week, we're going to talk about the demo, and we're going to talk about Iraq and what to do.
Yeah, we are. The third anniversary of the war.
So should we take
anniversary
some calls?
Is a strange word for this, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a celebration of the glorious what?
Yeah. Conquest.
Glorious horror. I don't know. And you know, I think that... I actually listened to Zagreb. How do you say it? Zagreb Brzezinski.
President Carter's national security advisor.
You know, I'm so ignorant, I can't pronounce Polish.
Right. Brzezinski. Zagreb. I'm with you on Brzezinski, but the
Zagreb.
Guy's first name.
Zagreb. It's too many consonants in one word. Anyway, he actually has a plan to get out. But should we take some calls about the parade?
Yeah, we should.
Let's take the calls about the parade first. 231-8187.
Kevin, good morning.
Good morning. Fellas, I didn't manage to make it. I was unfortunately under a doctor's knife having a bad cyst drained.
A bad cyst?
You know, there's something...
is there such a thing as a good cyst?
Well, I think that the exercise in the streets was probably similar as opposed to the Empire's bad accumulation of bad humors.
Mm.
But I wanted to give the props out for my daughter, Marissa, who demonstrated down at Chapman University in Orange.
Uh-huh.
And
in Orange County. That's bold.
Yes. The city of Orange in Orange County.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. She's in the heart of the mess.
Huh? Yeah.
But they were doing a demonstration there at the University of Oh, now I've forgotten, and I'll embarrass myself. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know, Fester Holden Pencil, the guy on competitor station, was counting people by tens passing a certain line.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Mm-hmm.
And he estimated that there were about 8,000.
Hmm. Okay.
So I just wanted to let you know that.
No, I appreciate that. It's hard to, you know, crowd estimating is literally that. It's estimating. And it doesn't really matter. Once you reach a kind of a, once you've covered the streets from the point of leaving the place to just about the place of coming back, that's it.
Well, anyway, take care.
Okay, thanks for the call, man.
But there's a solution to the crowd estimation.
What's that?
That we fence off the place and sell tickets.
Sell tickets.
No.
Make money. 231-8187.
Who do we have, Eduardo? James, good morning.
Good morning.
James!
Hey, what's up?
James, you know, people say we should never have anything to do with you. What is this?
I know, you guys.
And you're such a regular. You must love this show.
Advocating genocide.
Genocide!
Oh, hang on. You faded out there towards the beginning. Who's advocating genocide?
You guys accused me of advocating genocide.
We did.
Yes, I
don't recall accusing you of that.
I heard somebody on the air accuse me of advocating genocide.
Well, that's a caller. I don't think Joe or I accused you of advocating.
No, I've never thought you advocated genocide. Just for the record,
I do not advocate genocide.
Okay, I'm going to write it right here on your record, and we'll send it to the FBI. You do not advocate genocide. Okay.
I do advocate killing the enemy, though.
The enemy. You got a clear notion of who that is?
Anybody who takes up arms against our military force.
What about if the military force is in their country?
Well, we occupy the country, so it's our country now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I remember that. That was the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Guatemala, Iran at one point. Those are all our country.
So this sovereign government that we've set up is what? A meaningless gesture?
It's a puppet government for now.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad to hear you shooting straight, James. Thank you for
I always shoot straight. You know that.
Oh, of course you do.
Hey, James, do you have an actual point to make?
I wanted to call about, in the past, Abe, you were talking about the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And
why are you talking about intellectual stuff
like that? I just got to say, what does a commie pinko like you understand about the Enlightenment?
Yeah. What does a commie pinko like you understand about the Enlightenment?
Well, here's what I understand about the Enlightenment,
commie
James.
Pinko.
The Enlightenment and the philosophers that took part in it laid the groundwork for the formation of the modern democratic republics that make up most of the Western world. The first was ours, and most of the other European nations followed suit. Not right away, but that's how it's gone. So in a nutshell, James, that's what I understand about the Enlightenment.
Well, you should understand that the... one of the great principles to come out of the Enlightenment was capitalism and also individual property rights.
You know, actually, you're making an interesting point, but let me just point out something to you. If you read Wealth of Nations, which I think is what you're really talking about, Adam Smith.
I have read Wealth of Nations.
Yeah, okay, good. 1776. Then you'll remember that one of the points that Adam Smith makes is that as soon as there is an advantage, either in price, production, well, three things, price, production, or quality of goods, there's a tendency toward monopoly, and immediately the equity of the trade falls apart. Do you remember that?
A monopoly cannot exist without the state stepping in.
Not so. Not so.
Enable the monopoly.
Well, the actual enabling of capitalism or any other system of economics is, of course, the role of the state to a great extent. We all agree that.
Nobody really understands what capitalism. We've never seen true capitalism.
Ah, we've also never seen God.
Existed.
You know, it's kind of.
It's a theme, I guess. It's something that we should all strive for.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of like a goal. Listen, James, I want to give others the opportunity.
Okay.
We've never seen true capitalism. We saw the beginnings of true capitalism at the dawn of the industrial age, and we noticed that true capitalists did a number of things. They started hiring children.
Oh, yes.
They required very long work days.
Oh, yes.
They didn't give paid holidays.
Yes.
They gave... They didn't provide any sort of benefits to their employees.
No, and they fired at will.
They fired at will. They dumped stuff willy-nilly into rivers.
Yes.
They did all sorts of things.
Poisoned the environment.
They did. So the point I want to impress upon you, James, is that capitalism, left to its own devices, tends to get quickly out of hand. And this is why people like Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism, advocated an intelligently regulated marketplace.
Okay.
And there you have it.
That was good.
And to those people who call up here and wonder why we entertain phone calls from people like James, the simple answer is, this is KBOO and we take all comers.
And not only that, I want to add something. I think it's an important thing that there be dialogue with people with whom we disagree.
Agreed. Yeah. This is not the Lars Larson Show, where we screen every call and we don't allow anyone on the air who might contradict his Larsness.
Larsness. Your Larsness?
His Larsness, yes.
He has a gun kind of stuck right next to his...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we won't go there.
He's fearful.
So that's why we take James's calls, and that's why we're going to continue to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is a good defense of the James call. Although it is kind of interesting that James calls us every week, though.
Yeah.
We could institute the no more calls from anybody we know rule, which we did for a while. So.
Yeah, we quickly run through our dozens of listeners and then do it.
No, that's not true. There's a lot of people who try to get in. We don't have a lot of lines. You know, like a commercial talk station has like 6 or 7 lines.
Yeah.
And then they stack them up on the screen. And they tell you what part of town they are in, pro and con, you know, all that kind of stuff. We don't have any of that stuff.
No.
We don't have any of that.
Yeah, we don't screen anything.
No. No. We screen, no screening.
No.
Okay.
Rico, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Hey.
I didn't get to see the march. I ended up with my son and his friend right behind the first banner and right before the veterans group.
Oh, cool.
And it was outstanding being in the front and being able to see the people on the sidewalks and their reactions. And I hadn't been in a march since a large one in San Francisco in 71.
Wow.
And this one it just felt great. And my favorite moment was when they stopped us underneath the sky bridge at Pioneer Place waiting for one of the trains to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And as we paused, we looked west, and we were all stunned to see that the march was still walking, going as they were heading south, and we couldn't believe that the parade march was still going in full force that far behind us.
It was huge. It really was. And I have no idea how many people were there, but it was a lot of people.
And the other main feeling I got was I was pleasantly surprised at the diversity of ages of all the people that were around me at the front of the parade. I was around a lot of parents with little kids. I was around a lot of people much older than I am. And I was around a lot of other families that had their teenage kids with them.
You know, it's interesting. In France, where they do more demonstrations more often over more issues, it's customary for the political leadership of the country, actually, and famous personages to be in the first ranks. You know, here we don't do that. Our politicians tend to not be in the front ranks. They tend to, if they show up, they tend to hide in the middle. But I think it is important, and I think your point is really well taken. That is the diversity of people. There were also African Americans. There were huge numbers of Latinas and Latinos. It was, I would say, as diverse as our society can be, and I like that.
Yeah, I did too. It felt great. And so, anyway, thanks for the opportunity, and I'll definitely take advantage of the next one that comes around.
Well, I want you to do more than that. I want you to chalk the sidewalks. I want you to talk to friends and neighbors and even strangers. I want you to make sure that people understand in the most gentle but firm way possible that this administration has failed even in its mandate as a conservative administration because they're basically a bunch of crooks.
Okay, I'll take you up on the offer.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it was huge.
And they are a bunch of crooks.
They are a bunch of crooks.
I mean, let's stop kidding around. This is a bunch of crooks took over the U.S. government, man.
Oh, absolutely.
Bunch of crooks.
And they're trying to take over the world.
I think so.
Only they don't have enough volunteer soldiers to do it.
No, but they don't want to have a draft because their kids might have to go.
That's true. Speaking of volunteer soldiers, I heard a very interesting tidbit last week about the sorts of media that are available to the soldiers in Iraq.
What's that?
Via the Internet.
Really?
They are given free access to websites like Rush Limbaugh's website.
Okay.
Like the National Review Online.
Okay. Those are all right-wing.
Right-wing websites. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly's website.
Okay.
But they can't get onto Air America's website.
Is that true?
It's true. They can't get onto a number of the lefty blogs.
So they're basically censored away from the left and to the right.
Yeah. And a poll also that I read, I believe, the week before last, said that close to 80% of the troops in Iraq believe that they are there to get revenge for the attacks of September the 11th, 2001.
Well, that's what Bush said today in his press conference.
It is what
when
he said.
When Helen Thomas bravely...
Yeah, was that extraordinary?
Yes. Yeah, you didn't hear this, but she was. It was a broadcast live on NPR.
Yep.
Actually, during our regular news spot right before the show. A very important press conference in the sense that Bush just yammered on with his nonsense. Helen Thomas, the queen of the press corps, challenged him. You know, it was kind of fun. He tried to be funny and so on. But she challenged him repeatedly on his reasons for going to war.
She said, every reason that you have publicly given for the war in Iraq has turned out not to be true. So what's the real reason we went to war? This is what she asked the President of the United States.
And then he gobbledygooked.
Yeah, and this is what's his answer. September 11th, terror, 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 terror.
Right. No pre-plan. Yep. Woo, la. Anyway, I got to tell people, you're listening to Abe Proctor, Joe Uris. It's talk radio on KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. So far we're talking about the parade, which was great. Congratulations to those who organized it. Wonderful job. 231-8187 is the number to call to be on the air. But now we're going to talk about Iraq.
Yes, we're going to keep taking calls about the parade. We're going to keep taking calls about the war in general. But
and I want to even talk about the French troubles. I do. I want to spend a little time on that. Now, Hanford Watch, I want to get this in real quick. Watch, on March 22nd, that's tomorrow, Wednesday, a workshop at 6 p.m. and a meeting from 7 to 10 at the Red Lion Convention Center. Basic decisions are going to be made about using new data about what happens with the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. You know, it's partially poisoned. Is it going to be a park? What's going to happen to it? Many issues on the ongoing and final cleanup of the site will be addressed. It's really important to go to that. So that's the Hanford Watch, March 22nd, Wednesday, a workshop at 6, meetings from 7 to 10 at the Red Lion on Northeast Grand in Portland, Oregon. Okay?
Okay.
Tomorrow.
Right. So yesterday the president went to Cleveland and he gave a speech
in
support of the war in Iraq.
Yes, he did.
And he did something unusual. And that he took questions, unscripted questions, from the audience afterwards.
Yeah, you know, he's under pressure.
he is under pressure.
Yeah.
So someone in the audience asked him why he drew a connection between Saddam Hussein and the September 11th attacks.
Uh-huh.
And he answered, this is how he answered. He said he had been very careful not to say that Saddam Hussein had ordered the September 11th attacks.
Oh, good.
Which is true. He was very careful not to say that. But he spent a great deal of his time in the run-up to the war mentioning them in the same breath. he drew a very made a very strong circumstantial case that Iraq was behind this September 11th attacks without ever coming out and saying it.
And then he lied and lied and lied and lied and lied about Iraq.
And lied. So this, people are actually starting to field these questions and toss them at the president, and this he still is answering the same way.
Well, but it's interesting. They've shifted now. They're trying to kind of be more publicly conscious and inclusive. You know, taking a question from Helen Thomas, you know, he'd refused to take questions from her for a long time.
For a very long time.
And he takes a question. And of course, she was impatient, and she interrupted him several times, which is to his advantage.
He was dodging the question. Right. He said, she asked him what was the real reason, because all the other reasons were false.
And then he went blather, 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 and she said, what's the real reason?
Yeah. Well, so I can forgive her for interrupting him on that.
Oh, I can forgive her for interrupting him on any reason.
So in Cleveland, as these questions wore on and on, the president grew more and more uncomfortable up in front of the crowd. And towards the end, he blurted out, doesn't anybody work here in this town? He said to the people in Cleveland, as if this was a lunchtime speech, as if to say, don't you all have to get back to your jobs?
Well, how would he know about work?
Interestingly, as it turns out, not as many people work in Cleveland as did before his administration. In fact, 29% the unemployment rate has risen.
Could he be that blunderous?
Yeah. Yes, he could be that blunderous.
Nearly a third of the people are out of work, and he says, doesn't anybody work in this town?
Anybody work in this town? Well, as it turns out, not as many as used to. Mr. President.
Oh, how funny. Okay, let's take some calls. 231-8187.
Good morning. Who do we have? Steve,
good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
You're on the air, Steve.
What's that?
You're on the air.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning. I'm on the air. Hey, all right. So you had your little hoopla. You had your march, right?
Yes, we did.
We did.
And you had your, 30 seconds of media time at, 11 o'clock news on all three stations.
Well, four, but okay.
Okay, 4 minutes.
Maybe five. No, okay. I mean five stations.
Okay. What do you do now?
Good question. Very good question.
Okay, because here's a prediction that I'm going to make.
Okay.
A year from now, we're still going to be in Iraq, and we're possibly going to even attack Iran.
That's possible.
Okay, you're going to have a fourth anniversary march, possibly a fifth anniversary march. What do you do?
Declare a national holiday? I don't know.
I'm in favor of what we're doing there, but I'm asking you, people believe that we shouldn't be there. We shouldn't liberate the Iraqi people from a tyrant.
Well, wait a minute. That's kind of like, when did you stop beating your wife type question? Liberating, we shouldn't be there. We shouldn't liberate the Iraqi people from a tyrant, etc. Don't you see that you're loading the question?
Okay, well, let's back up then.
All right, let's take these one at a time. What should we do? Well, the fact is that the Republicans control all three branches of government. That's probably not going to be a political solution to our satisfaction to this debacle. So what do? We use the only tools available that are at our disposal. We write and phone our representatives in Congress continuously.
You do that. Okay, but how many of the 8,000 people that you say were there do that?
I don't know, Steve. The best we can do is encourage them to do it.
Actually, Steve, I want to talk to you about a concept I mentioned earlier, but it's very important. There's something in politics, in mass politics, called the tipping point.
Okay.
Okay, this is a point that no one can predict it. No one knows exactly when it is. But at some point, public sentiment, the general reality of the situation, and this is true of all political struggles everywhere, becomes so intense that there is a groundswell of cultural, political, and social change that overwhelms any
resistance. I agree with you if you have the people behind you, but there's a majority of people like me who believe what the president is doing is correct and right, and you got to admit that this president, as much as you put him down, he's got one thing, and that's resolve. He really doesn't care about a certain segment of popular opinion because he feels what he's doing is right.
All right, Steve, let's back up here one moment. The question was never whether Saddam Hussein was a good man or a good leader or whether he deserved to be in power. The question was always, was it wise to depose him by force, and should we embark on that course? And our answer to that has always been an overwhelming no. It's not a good idea to depose him by force, and it's not a good idea to embark on that course. And everything that has happened since we did that has borne that opinion out. The war in Iraq is an unmitigated disaster with no sign of getting any better, and we've put ourselves in an absolutely untenable position. We can't stay because our presence incites the violence that rages there every single day, and we can't leave because to do so would be to see the place devolve into utter chaos. So I ask you, Steve, what good has come out of the invasion of Iraq?
You guys are yelling at each other.
Stop. When there's a totally other side of the story of soldiers who I have personally talked to have come back and said that the Iraqi people are happy with there. They're making a difference, albeit it's slow, but they are making a difference.
Well, let's talk a little bit
about it. It's a matter of opinion. Who do you talk to?
Well, that's a good point. Let's talk a little bit about what...
I agree with you in that
you're not gonna let
some
me talk,
people
are you?
Disagree with the soldiers being there and what is going on, but there's also segments of the Iraqi society that agree and are happy that we are there.
I'm sure there are.
Saddam is no longer there.
I think many people are glad Saddam's no longer there. But let me just talk about some practical things. The actual supply of electricity in all of Iraq and in Baghdad is less hours than it was before the invasion. The actual supply.
You're kidding, because it's.
Well, let me finish now. Let me go a little list.
And you... Go on.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Then there is the problem of electricity beyond that. There is the problem of how that affects the sewer systems, the fresh water supplies, the infrastructure in general. The fact of the matter is that what we stepped into for reasons that are never been clear to me except perhaps for oil, what we stepped into is an unending mess which is going to take millions, billions of dollars and countless lives of Iraqis and of Americans with no clear end in sight. And I'll make you a bet that the way this administration is going to want to solve this is either to attack Syria or to attack Iran. And it's simply an expanding and unending war. Meanwhile, and you may not be aware of this, but you should know it, throughout the world, the general public opinion of the United States has dropped to its lowest point since, I don't know when, since the 1898 or something.
Who cares what France cares about and thinks about us? I really don't give a crap.
Where did France come into this picture?
Well, okay, I'm just throwing out a nation.
Well, how about China? How about Great Britain?
You don't care about any of those guys? We feel we're doing what is right. Who cares what they think?
If we don't care what... Wait a minute, look at your...
None of these countries want to step up and liberate people.
Well, wait a minute. Listen. No, you're not going to listen. Okay.
Who shows up to disasters around the world? We do.
Actually, we've been dragging our feet showing up to disasters around the world. But hey, I'm with you, Steve. Let's keep the liberation train a-rolling. Who's next, Steve?
Iran.
Syria. China.
Iran.
Cambodia.
Right.
Where are we going
right.
to stop?
Korea.
Let's not stop till we've
Korea.
Liberated them all. And the piles of dead are there as an altar to the great God of liberation. Thank you for the call, Steve. That's enough.
You got upset.
Yeah, I got upset. He's telling us we're doing the right thing, but he hasn't given it. Didn't give us any reason why we're doing the right thing.
He said
the nation of Iraq is better because they've been liberated from the tyrant. Well, how the hell are they better? Until enough of them are dead?
Well, I think there's a larger point, which is the United States really going to turn itself into the arbitrary liberator of some places and not others? I mean, we already are. I mean, we support dictatorships around the world.
Of course we do. We support them when they're convenient economically, and we oppose them when it's convenient.
And, of course, historically, we have created dictatorships. In fact, if you want to understand what's happened in the Middle East, you got to look at the question of blowback, as you know. Iran had a legitimate government in 1953, an elected government. We didn't like it. We and the British overthrew that government. The government of Mossadegh, and created a government of the oil industry and the puppet, the Shah of Iran. And that government was the government that collapsed finally in the 70s to great disaster. And that government that came in its place is the one we're dealing with right now. And it's a nasty bunch.
Yeah, and the government that's arming a Shia militia in Iraq.
Exactly. So this is blowback, and we have never apparently as a nation understood the impact of our meddling in other countries' politics. We had blowback in, we knocked off the government of our Benz in Guatemala in 54 for the United Fruit Company. And the result of that, years and years later, was the horrible, virtually genocidal slaughters that went on in Central America again in the 70s and 80s, 90s. So, yeah. You know, this is, we have to understand the price of our kind of meddling. The Congo, the same thing when we had Patrice Lumumba knocked off. You know, come on! Don't, no one should misunderstand. We are often too quick with our power and too slow with our intelligence and morality. And that's a problem for a powerful, in fact, the only superpower, sort of superpower left. And in fact, what world opinion thinks about us, and I think we need to be clear about this, really does matter. It matters on so many levels, particularly when the United States is so aggressive.
Yes.
Ha!
All right.
A deep breath. I want to mention, before we go to the next bunch of callers, and I know there's lots of them out there, I want to talk about, I saw an interview on TV, of all places, on, I think it was C-SPAN. No, it was, as a matter of fact, it was PBS News, regular McNeil Lear, or whatever the hell they're called nowadays, news thing, Zagreb Brzezinski.
Carter's.
National Security Advisor, who is actually pretty conservative guy, was asked what the heck we should do. And he had four steps about Iraq. And he said, first, ask the Iraqi government, you know, to ask us to leave. That was his first step. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, he said that gets us off the hook of our commitment. See? Secondly, get the Iraqi government and the U.S. to get together to announce a date within a year or less, when we will be gone, thus putting pressure on the Iraqis to figure out a solution to their current civil war. And then, third, ask all the Arab neighbors, and I guess that would I would include Iran, but he didn't, ask the Arab neighbors for help in creating some system of order in Iraq, kind of a self-policed within the culture of Islam thing. And then the fourth thing, convene a conference of donor nations, wealthy nations, to help have a conference to help rebuild Iraq under Iraqi leadership.
Makes sense to me.
It's a plan. It's a lot cheaper than the war. So, you know, and he's assuming, okay, Saddam is gone and things could be better, but this is what has to be done. And I don't hear it happening.
No.
I don't think it's going to happen. You know why I don't think it's going to happen? I think it's not going to happen because the underlying thing is about energy, and it's about pride and power and the ability to assert and control within the region.
It is. It's about an attempt to secure by force the remaining resources of the petroleum-driven industrial age.
I think so.
And Steve blew that off as a liberal crap trap. This is how he did it. Oil. That's how I interpret blowing it off as liberal claptrap. But it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
231-8187.
Robert, good morning. Hello.
Robert?
No, guess not.
No, Robert.
No. Tim.
Hey, guys. I got out to the march yesterday with my wife and son. I wanted to mention some of my favorite parts. I love the guys in Abu Ghraib. Orange jumpers with the hoods. That was really powerful.
Yes.
I loved the guys out there that were wearing the suits, mirrored sunglasses, acting like FBI agents.
I missed them. That's cool.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And I loved the people trapped under the Burnside Bridges in their cars, trying to explain to their kids what was going on for 2 hours. I thought that was great. And I just wanted to remind everybody that this was a world march. People came out all over the world for peace, and they're going to keep doing it. And we were all part of that. And the Oregonian had rotating pictures on the front page. When I loaded it, I got the upside-down American flag.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to thank the Oregonian for giving coverage, and I want to thank the police for smiling and understanding what we're out there for peace. And that's about it, guys. Thanks for doing a good job.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for the call. And again, let's praise the organizers of this. I want to be clear. So people say, well, what good does it do to march? The answer is twofold. First of all, you don't know because of the tipping point issue.
Right.
Really important. Second of all, it shows the world that there is great dissatisfaction with the foreign policy and offers alternatives. And third of all, it strengthens our numbers when we see our numbers so large. It gives us courage.
It does. It's a very heartening sort of endeavor.
Oh, I felt so good.
And also, in terms of world opinion, it allows, when news of this gets out, it allows people in other countries to realize that we are not a monolithic nation united behind an aggressive foreign policy.
Yeah, you know, this is a misunderstanding. A lot of people in Europe, actually, that I've encountered, think that the American people are in favor of this war. And, you know, now it's time, hopefully it will be the case, people become clear that we have this runaway pseudo-Republican, because it's not real Republican, pseudo-Republican bunch, who are in charge currently of all three houses of the government, you know, of the judiciary, of the executive, and of the legislative. And that is very scary. And we, as Americans, most of us who pay any attention at all, unfortunately not enough of us pay attention, are very concerned. In fact, we're outraged. And I think that's the message that needs to be sent around the world. And again, when people say, well, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks, I think 9/11 proved that it really matters what the rest of the world thinks.
It very much matters what the rest of the world thinks, because the rest of the world has grown so economically interdependent with every other part of the world.
And powerful. You know, we're not the only player in the game anymore.
No, we're not.
All right, 231-8187.
There's also the fact that past marches really haven't received much media coverage. But now that we're approaching that tipping point, and perhaps have even passed it, they are starting to garner media coverage.
Isn't that interesting?
But yeah, it is. But even when they weren't garnering media coverage, you can be sure that people in power notice when thousands of people are in the street. And when it comes right down to it, I think that's the one thing that governments truly fear. It's people in the streets by the thousands.
The people themselves, they fear them. They feel direct democracy, because when the representative democracy system fails, they know that the legitimacy of the government is under challenge. In fact, Nixon went crazy. You know, part of the reason for his Watergate behavior and that whole thing was he would walk out to the demonstrations, you know, and try to talk to the demonstrators. It drove him crazy. He wanted to put them all in jail. At one point, I want to point this out, at one point in one of the great marches in Washington, D.C., the government actually arrested, for no reason, it detained 5,000 demonstrators, or possible demonstrators, even scooping people off their porches if they looked wrong. And every one of those people was paid money by the government in a settlement for being wrongfully detained. And they were held in a kind of prison compound, not unlike what was built in Chile by the Pinochet regime with the support of the CIA. You know, so it was very scary for those people.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. Who do we have? Lewis.
Good morning, Lewis.
It's hard work.
It is.
I just heard that repeated numberless times on the press conference that just concluded. I don't know if you guys were aware that was going on.
Oh, yeah, yes. We talked about it a little bit.
Heard the first portion.
The president saying it's hard work, huh?
Well,
how would he know? He never works hard.
I'm wondering how many other people, other than myself, have the reiterations I'm hearing coming from the administration have come to sound more and more like a defense, as though an international tribunal was already taking place.
Well, that's an interesting thought.
No, that has actually been my impression. They are so redundant and not varying. It's not as though they're strategizing at all for anything other than sort of reinforcing a defense case, as though they were already facing a tribunal, an international tribunal. And that may sound like an excessively optimistic outcome, but that's the sense I have about it. And I'd like to know if any other people feel like they are simply shoring up, trying to shore up a position that is defensible.
You mean like they've already lost and they know it, sort of?
Yes. That's exactly it. That Bush's composure is crumbling more and more the more he's before the media, and his reiterations are nonsense. I mean, they're almost comedic.
Well, and it's interesting because he feels the need now, or at least his advisors. It's hard to tell whether he has any knowledge at all personally, but somebody has decided that he needs to be more frank and to be more out there taking questions that are unscripted, which is a big change. And you know, maybe these are skills that he can acquire. He hasn't yet got them. But it's sort of entertaining to see him trying to deal with real people asking real questions and not exactly being comfortable. In fact, not exactly doing a very good job of it. So,
if you get a chance to see a rerun of the conference, notice how he looks down at the rostrum each time he calls upon anyone's name.
Well, to be fair, that's normal.
It's a seating chart.
It's a seating chart, and they routinely have those.
Yes, okay, but he mispronounces the names.
Well, that is a Bushism.
Well,
yeah,
that's typical as well.
My point is he seems. There seems to be a defensiveness there. And anyway, I'm just wondering if a number of people in the administration, and maybe Bush himself, well, I don't know if that guy has much presence of consciousness, but I'm just wondering if they haven't already concluded that there will come a time, or there is feasibly a time coming, when they will have to face tribunals of one kind or another. So anyway, I'll get off the line. Goodbye.
It's hard to imagine any American president or any high-ranking U.S. government official, for that matter, facing an international tribunal.
Well, Kissinger, for example.
Right. For the simple reason that there's an allergy in this country politically to compromising our sovereignty in any way, real or perceived. And I think to hand over, especially an American president, to an international criminal court would be seen far and wide, especially by conservative elements in this country, as a gross compromise of our national sovereignty. So I think if anybody in this criminal administration is ever going to be held accountable, it's going to be in the United States Court of Law. And that's assuming that pardons aren't issued to the guilty parties at some point.
And then you have your Supreme Court that is, before this administration's done, very likely to be a 5-4 reactionary court.
Right. So barring impeachment, which is improbable but still possible, I don't think that anybody is ever going to be held legally to account for their actions in this whole sordid affair.
You know, I just want to, speaking of the court, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor, who just retired from the court, who is a conservative, true conservative, has made a speech which I have been trying to get a copy of. Apparently there's no copy available so far. She made a speech that was picked up by NPR in which she essentially warned of the dominance of the executive branch and of the destruction of American democracy in the current situation. This is a conservative former member of the Supreme Court. So I think it's very interesting. I think a lot of people are getting alarmed at the situation, thoughtful people. And I'm hoping that there's enough of that alarm that it'll finally reach the, as I say, the tipping point.
Agreed. But even if public opinion or you know, political critical mass, as it were, is achieved, there still are no consequences, really, that are going to await these people. And that's really the root of why we're in this position. There has been no accountability for these people, and there will be no accountability for these people in the foreseeable future. And that's really why they've been able to get away with what they've gotten away with.
And I'm not sure it even matters whether they're personally politically accountable. What really matters is that we change the direction of this culture. You know, while we chat away, and while this horrible war goes on, and while other adventures are planned or carried out, the fact of the matter is that domestically, they're destroying America. They're putting enormous debt on future generations. They are robbing all of the public lands and giving them to their friends, their private friends, for exploitation. They're destroying the environment. They're creating more and more global warming. They're destroying civil liberties at home. These guys are really bad news.
They are. But I think I'm going to have to disagree with you. I think personal accountability is very important in this situation for the following reason. What we're looking at right now is one-party rule. And we're looking at steps that have been taken to ensure one-party rule forever and ever. Amen. Because the congressional districts have been gerrymandered. Voting systems have been co-opted by unreadable and untraceable electronic voting machines. The whole situation has been compromised to the point that we may not be able to disenfranchise this one-party system of rule. Therefore, unless we see personal accountability for these people in the near future, the precedent that is being set right now may extend for the rest of our lifetimes and the lifetimes of our children. That is a very distinct possibility here. Well, that is a tipping point that may have already been reached.
That is possible, but I don't want to acknowledge it simply because it's too terrifying. That's number one, purely my personal emotional feeling. But secondly, I keep thinking that somehow the cowards that call themselves the Democratic Party will recognize this very real danger and will reach out to the people and create a movement of such power that this whole thing will be brought to an end.
Agreed.
I don't see it yet.
But there
I
is no sign of that.
No sign of that.
And one of our upcoming shows, as soon as we can line up a slate of guests, is going to be Where Are the Democrats? But I want to make a brief comment on that and reference something that's recently happened here.
Sure.
Senator Feingold of Wisconsin, as you may have heard, introduced a motion to censure the president in the Senate within the last few weeks. Now, a censure is it carries no legal weight. It carries no political consequences. It is simply the Congress saying, shame on you, shame on you, Mr. President. Now, the Democrats have run from this.
Yes, they have.
And I'm forced to wonder exactly why. The Democrats have no power here. They don't control any branch of government. They don't control either of the houses of Congress. They can't call, they can't issue subpoenas. They can't call hearings. And when the Republicans do call hearings, they don't even make witnesses make statements under oath.
Isn't that amazing?
Right. So the Democrats are toothless here. So you'd think that symbolic gestures would be what they were all about at this point. For instance, unanimous opposition to Supreme Court nominations.
Right.
Unanimous Democratic votes for censure. Unanimous Democratic votes in opposition to administration policies. You'd think by this point that they would have learned that they get nothing by compromising with this administration except more black eyes.
You'd think at least occasionally in Congress they'd all stand up and turn their back.
Yeah, you'd think so. But they haven't done that. They haven't done that at all because they're a bunch of cowards, except for Senator Feingold, who consistently, I must say, has spoken in opposition to this administration.
Well, he's not the only one, but there's a few.
And even before this administration, Feingold was the co-author of a very comprehensive, very intelligent piece of campaign finance legislation that eventually ended up getting passed into law in kind of a bastardized form.
Mm-hmm.
But he, for a long time, has embodied integrity in government. So he was recently on the Charlie Rose show. And Charlie Rose asked him about why the Democrats ran and hid when he proposed censuring the president. This is what he said. Shades of October 2002. These are the same pundits, consultants, and spinmeisters who said, you've got to vote for the Iraq War or George Bush is going to hang you out to dry, and he's going to show you that you don't care about the troops and you don't care about the fight against terrorism. They pull it every time. And the Democratic insiders in Washington and the consultants fall for it every time. They don't realize that the thing that bugs people about the Democratic Party right now is that we don't seem to stand strongly enough for what we believe in. How can we be afraid at this point of standing up to a president who has clearly mismanaged this Iraq war, who clearly made one of the largest blunders in American foreign policy history? How can it be that this party wants to stand back and allow this kind of thing to happen?
I think the Democrats, to the degree they have some consciousness of this, just want to stay out of the way until Bush hangs himself.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen.
No,
that's not enough. When the sitting president has, in every poll, shows approval ratings in the 30% range, that's when you kick him in the teeth. But they just refuse to do this, time and time and time again. It disgusts me, I got to tell you.
I can tell that you're somewhat upset.
I am somewhat upset.
History
will judge the Democratic Party as the opposition party that wasn't, as the opposition party that stood by and let these bastards hijack the republic. That is how history is going to judge these people.
231-8187. Want to hear from you. Who's next? Steve, you're on
Steve,
the air.
Steve, good morning.
Oh, hey. This is just a point that I don't hear raised very often, if at all, really quickly. Years ago, if you would have asked a Republican if he wanted to go and invade a country to liberate some Arab people from an evil dictator that we helped set up, they would have just looked at you and thought that you were from another planet and crazy.
Yeah, I hold on a second. I just want to emphasize one of the things you said. We created Saddam Hussein. We created him and we gave him weapons and power so he could have a war against Iran. It's, again, another example of short-sighted behavior by the U.S. government that leads to blowback. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's the point. It just, if you remember Somalia, it just shows how short people's memory are. How short people's memory can be about, Somalia, we were there, the Republicans wanted out, and George Bush the first was the guy that got us in there in the first place. And as soon as Clinton got elected, it was all about, how we can't be involved in nation building, and it didn't matter, what sort of state the people were suffering under. We had to get out of there. But with Iraq now, because George Bush says it's okay that we have to liberate these people, they all fall into line. they buy whatever they're told, and they don't really, they never think critically about any of it.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about Bush's press conference today, Little George, was that he essentially said that he had learned a lesson. He didn't say it in these words, but he said, we learned a lesson. He learned a lesson, he says, at 9/11, that we couldn't not be nation-building, that we had to be nation-building. See, this is his total rationale. 9/11 becomes the end-all and be-all and the rationale for everything. And because Americans were so shocked and so horrified that we could be, in fact, attacked, which, by the way, continues to be a problem, because we haven't, this government actually hasn't done much to shore up or secure relevant ports and so on. With that, he felt that he had, given the terror of the American people, a kind of mandate to do whatever the hell they wanted. And the thing that Helen Thomas asked him was, you know, we know you planned to have this war just about the time you entered office, which is true. And he just simply shined that on. He didn't want to deal with that. The fact of the matter is that the crowd that runs the president and the president himself are definitely into conquering and capturing and controlling, particularly the natural resources, particularly oil, in the world. There's no question of that.
Well, I just think that it's interesting that they're creating a cult of personality around a guy who has no personality. That's really ironic to me.
That's because you never were in a fraternity. I wasn't either. I was just a glib thing. Anyway, thanks for the call, man.
The reason that a cult of personality has been created around this president is because he's been a convenient vessel for the projections of a whole lot of Americans who were very frightened by what happened on September the 11th.
Oh, yeah.
They needed to perceive a very strong, very warlike, very...
dumb.
No, that's not what they needed to perceive. They needed to perceive these sort of qualities of strength and aggression in their leader. Because they felt kicked and vulnerable.
But he was the lowest common denominator. When I say dumb, I shouldn't say dumbish. When I say stupid, the fact of the matter is that he actually appeals to the simplest minded response.
Yes, he does, and he takes pride in that.
Yeah.
But my point is that he was a willing and a vessel for their projections, and he has stepped into that role quite effectively in the days following the September 11th attacks.
No, you're right. 2318187 Phoenix.
Phoenix shall rise again. Good morning.
Hey. Hi, Abe. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Just want to let you know, Joe, that I made some impeached T-shirts for you. I was at the march with them.
Oh, I didn't get one.
I know. I wanted to give you one, but I don't know what you look like.
See,
I'm tan, but not too tan. 6'2", blonde, blue eyes.
Chiseled.
Chiseled features, very, very, very,
tight
very
buns.
Beautiful.
Yeah, well, I think I saw Abe. I heard anyway a conversation about First Amendment or some kind of speech with a man talking to his son. It might have been you, Abe.
It might have been me.
Abe also is 6'2".
Chiseled, blonde, yeah, I saw him then.
Anyway, the fact of the matter is that I'm just an old grumpy guy, and you can find me, or you can, if you really want to give us T-shirts, but you have to give Abe one, too, because, you know, he gets jealous, and then our relationship crumbles.
I'll get him down to KBOO.
I think that's the best way to go.
Quite a few. It was really impressive because many people were getting them, and it was all for benefit of Code Pink.
Oh, cool.
We like Code Pink.
What's that?
We like Code Pink.
I went to the Code Pink, the Iraqi woman who spoke, sponsored by Code Pink last night.
Uh-huh.
And in response to, some of the things Steve said, you know, she said that Saddam, when Saddam was in power, the people could walk to the store and get bread without being shot.
Yes.
Yeah. And the liberation of the Iraqi women didn't happen. You know, they lost their husbands, they have no food, they have no water, they have nothing.
Right.
So it's very, very sad. So Steve is a little confused. And I wanted to bring up the fact that I've been doing some Buddhist reading,
mm-hmm.
which illuminates the development of the ego, which is pretty fascinating because I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Chogyam Trungpa, he says that ego's intelligence is tremendously is talented. It's mm-hmm. not intelligent, but it's very talented, and it can distort anything, which is kind of what we're dealing with the regime and the distortion of the word usage. And, you know, the word liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, so many other words have been distorted and used in a bastardly fashion. And what he also says, which is pretty funny about the monkey mind, Let me see if I can find the page here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The monkey's state of mind becomes very distorted and disturbed as suddenly this mental jigsaw puzzle erupts and his thought patterns become irregular and unpredictable because he's so desperate to get back to the pleasure realms of the gods, which is really, really fascinating. And, you know, when we come from this standpoint, I mean, it's helping me to understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I made the impeached T-shirts for you and your idea, and also because just with that impeach word out there, you know, and people can wear these T-shirts, and we create new thought forms, and we can say, this is possible. And when we're moving into action, if we keep saying, yeah, impeachment is possible, and we're going to do it, we're going to,
well,
yeah.
Let me just say, of course, I think impeachment's a good idea, personally, but in practical political terms, and this has nothing to do with the value of the T-shirt or what you're suggesting,
mm-hmm.
in real-world terms, given the current political situation, impeachment, first of all, has lost its impact. It was significant as enough of a significant threat that Richard Nixon would resign the presidency faced with it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Clinton debacle, where essentially impeachment became a political tool of the power of the Republican Party,
mm-hmm.
Based on the fact that Clinton lied about the stain on the dress, I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
The meaning of impeachment was lost. And then on top of that, the fact that we have a Congress which is safely, sadly, in the hands of the same bunch of pseudo-Republicans means that impeachment as a practical matter, it's pretty far away. It's going to take a lot of sea changes in America before that actually could happen. But calling for it, as you suggest, presenting the idea that this government is not legitimate is a good idea. So impeach Bush T-shirts still make sense.
Okay.
I think they're cool.
I'll get them down to KBOO for
you. I'll wear it.
Me too.
What size? Chiseled?
Oh, let's see. When I want to look sexy, it's a medium. When I want to have a loose thing, it's a large.
I wear an XL.
Yeah, he's really big.
All right.
Thanks, Phoenix.
Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you very much. 231-8187. We're going to get T-shirts, man.
We are. Impeachment.
And they say this station doesn't pay.
Impeachment's not out of the question. It's going to require both houses of Congress going over to the Democrats, and it's going to require those Democrats to have the political will to do it. Yeah, you're right. It's out of the question. Annie, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. Oh, and yes, Joe, I did hear something about Sandra Day O'Connor's comments,
uh-huh.
you know, that we're slipping off into fascism.
Yeah, it's essentially
and,
what she said.
A dictatorship, I believe, is what she said. And
yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, and I just love George when he's talking about hard work and he rolls his sleeves up.
Yeah,
is that not just adorable?
I think it's cute. I think it's very cute.
It's just cute. And he just, you know, he likes to say he's just down here with us folks. And you know what? He wouldn't touch anything that we touch because he's much too fine. And then I'm wondering, you know, with all this great liberation that's going on, who will liberate us from these psychotic Bushes? Is that a short eye or a long eye?
You know, it's really a good question. Who's going to save us from ourselves? I guess the answer is the American people.
Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lordy.
Oh, you're so cynical.
Help me, Rhonda. Anyway, thanks so much, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you,
okay,
Annie.
Thank you.
Appreciate
for the call.
She's
a little cynical. She's a little embittered.
A little bit, yeah.
But,
well,
you know,
people
have
said that about us, too.
I continue to have hope.
All right.
I expect the worst and hope for the best. That's my line. At 9 on Between the Covers, you get to hear an interview with Sharman Apt Russell, author of An Obsession with Butterflies, which is quite interesting. At 9:30, Paige Knight of Hanford Watch, we just talked about their meeting tonight, will be in to discuss this week's meeting on what will happen with Hanford's nuclear reservation and its terribly toxic waste. By that way, their meeting is Wednesday night, March 22nd, workshop at 6, and the meeting from 7 to 10 at the Red Lion Convention Center Hotel, 1021 Northeast Grand here in Portland, right by the MAX tracks. And then at 10, it's a special documentary called Girls from Cambodia, with firsthand accounts of young Cambodian women speaking frankly about being sold into sexual slavery and escaping their captors. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, which I really think is a great show, hear an interview with a reporter from Time Magazine who broke the story about an investigation into allegations that some Marines shot and killed 15 civilians, including 7 women and 3 children, in the Iraqi town of Haditha last November in an apparent act of revenge for the death of a U.S. soldier. And there's been more incidents like that, by the way, coming to light. And former Republican strategist Kevin Phillips, who is, I think, a brilliant man, discusses his new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. And I would list those. It may be in a different order, but it's Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money.
Yeah, Kevin Phillips is brilliant. He's no liberal. He's one of these people.
He's a true conservative.
He is. Yeah. He's one of these people like Paul Krugman, who is a liberal. But he comes from the same place with his criticisms as Krugman does. And those are very concrete, very real world, often very financially based criticisms of neoconservative policy. So he's well worth listening to.
You know, the kind of almost religious fervor with which these weird economic policies are embraced today just really puzzles me. I'm looking at this French thing where the French are trying to figure out a way to freshen up their economy, you know. In fact, everybody in Europe is facing this because this highly competitive world system that's been created recently leaves people who are well paid and who have good benefits and so on out in the cold. So the French are trying to create a system where they would open things up for young people by essentially allowing employers to hire them for 2 years and then any time during that 2 years, fire them for no reason.
And this helps them how?
Beats me. But that's sort of in a way it's hoping that some of the French people of North African and so on backgrounds would get more opportunity. I don't think so. It's really basically a way to create a fast flowing, badly paid lower end worker class. And of course the young French people and the labor unions are up in arms about it. And it's creating a crisis in France. Very interesting. This needs to be paid attention to.
And, yeah, it does.
You know, and it has legs. It could bring down the French government. Majority of the French people side with the only 10% who are in the labor unions and side with the students and side with a lot of other people who are very concerned with the loss of social democracy in France and the rest of Europe.
And it wasn't very long ago that suburbs of Paris were on fire.
That's true. That's true.
At the hands of these same disenfranchised French people of African descent.
Well, it's an interesting crisis that Europe faces. You know, it really is. There's a whole bunch of nations that imported for various political reasons and for economic reasons what they thought would be low-priced labor, and the low-priced labor turned out to be wanting citizenship and equal treatment after many, many years of being patient.
How dare they?
How dare they? 231-8187. We've talked today about Brzezinski's plan for the U.S. to get out of Iraq. We've talked about the marvelous parade. I'm going to call it a parade from now on, not demonstration. Marvelous parade on Sunday. We've talked about the horrors of Iraq, and we've talked about the destruction of things here at home.
And I yelled at a guy.
And you yelled at a guy.
Yeah.
You lost it.
Yeah, I did.
All right. We want to hear from you. 231-8187.
Well, he brought up that canard.
Which
the canard is, well, why aren't you talking about the good news in Iraq? Well, let me give you an analogy about that. All right, let's say that here in Portland, bombs were going off every day, and dozens of people were dying every day, including innocent people in their homes, children, and so on.
No fresh water.
No fresh water.
No sewer system that works.
Do you think the news would be reporting about the school that got a new coat of paint?
Well, why do you hate America so much?
I don't know. Who do we have? Julian. Good morning.
Good morning. I agree with so many things that you all said today, but as somebody who considers himself left of left, let's say, I have to say that it's like, you know, being diagnosed with terminal cancer and the course of treatment is flossing.
Is what-thing?
Flossing.
Flossing.
Ah.
When Abe recommended as a solution calling your congressman or congresswoman as one of the solutions to what's going on. I mean, to me, it's laughable, okay? I mean, what happened this weekend is another example of a parade slash circus, as Malcolm X would say, which has no basis in reality. Mm. You know, it's billed as a march. It was billed as a march to end the war. But as one of your callers said, it's really about people going out to feel good about themselves. You know, you've got people marching whose intention is supposedly to end the war, Mm-hmm. But the result of what they're doing is to feel better about their participation in opposition. It had no effect on anything political. It had no effect on any kind of policy.
Well,
it had no effect on the war whatsoever, but it made everybody feel good. They got to sing some songs. You know, they got to put some good rhymes together on a piece of paper, but more Iraqis are dying today. More U.S. soldiers are dying today. And let me say this, too. You guys said a lot of stuff that makes a lot of sense. This country has a history of overthrowing governments, you know, Democratic administrations as well as Republican, which means that we have a bankrupt system, and yet we've got people advocating going to those people, those corrupt politicians, and asking them, begging them to stop what they started. Now, I want to ask you guys, when do we stop marching around in circles, and when do we march on the White House, take Bush's furniture out, remove him from the White House, remove these congresspeople? When do we take the country back? Because it's clear it's already a tyranny. You know, it's clear that it's already a fascist. It's not becoming a fascist government. It is a fascist government. But left-wing people won't advocate taking the country back. You know, this is a strategic problem. And marching around in circles is not the answer to the problem. It's seizing power. When do we start talking about seizing power?
You're asking me why do we not advocate violent revolution?
And I didn't say anything about violence.
You talked about marching into the White House and throwing the president's furniture out.
When do we seize power? Is removing his furniture a violent act?
Yes, it is.
Really?
Yes, it is. If we believe in anything that we profess to hold dear, meaning representative self-government, meaning the rule of law, meaning all these things that we cherish, we can't walk into the White House and throw the president's furniture out, however satisfying that might feel.
Have you read the Declaration of Independence?
Yes, I certainly have.
Really? Do you know the part in the Declaration of Independence where it says when your government fails in its obligations to the people have the right to remove that government?
Yes, we do, but I'd rather do that at the ballot box.
You'd rather do it at the ballot box?
Yes,
when
I
they
would.
Fix the ballot. When they arrange to eliminate black voters from the voter rolls in various states, when they use electronic voting to make votes disappear for the opposition and create votes for them. So you're saying that you can actually change things at that level?
Yeah, I'm saying you can. What you're wishing for, Julian, here? I don't really think you want. I don't really think you want what you say you want.
Well, I think let me get into this a little bit, because I think it's an interesting, a very interesting real world test that you're talking about. I think there is a thing that happens, which I earlier alluded to and talked about the tipping point. I still believe that there is a point at which the legitimacy of the government becomes so challenged and so questionable that it no longer can effectively rule. Now, what you're saying, and you may be right, is that these guys are such fascists that simply wouldn't matter. And I don't know that we're there yet. That's where I'm coming from.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Election 2000, war in Iraq, the lies about Saddam Hussein being responsible for 9/11,
mm-hmm.
what they supposedly weren't saying,
mm-hmm.
the election of 2004, the war in Afghanistan, the possibility that this administration engineered 9/11, okay? What are we waiting for?
Well,
when are we going to start creating strategies that address the reality? Let me just say this and I'll shut up. I want to hear you guys answer this question.
Sure.
You talk about the legacy, years of overthrowing governments, years of setting up death squads in other countries, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're
mm-hmm.
talking about 50 to 100 years of imperialism, okay? This country has a track record of oppression globally. And you're going to tell me that the only response is moral suasion or voting or walking around in circles? I'm sorry, you guys are living in a dream world. Give me some strategies that will actually work, because you know this march didn't do anything. Tell me what's really going to work.
I advocate anything short of civil war, Julian, and that's what you're talking about when you're talking about seizing power. That civil war helps no one. It is ruinous. It destroys the infrastructure physically and politically of a nation for generations. I want to stop anywhere short of that.
I'm talking about seizing power.
I'm talking about, okay, then how about a general strike? How about a constitutional convention? I realize the spirit that you're citing in the Declaration of Independence, the need, the duty of a people to throw off a government that has failed to govern in the people's best interests. I understand that and I celebrate that. But that was written, listen for a second.
You're shirking that responsibility by what you're saying.
Julian, that was written in a different era. And while the spirit of that still holds, the government now has F-15s, the government has chemical and nerve agents. The government has a whole bunch of things that make the possibility of a successful armed revolution next to nil.
Okay, so what you're saying there, Abe, is that it's a matter of fear.
Yeah, I'm saying we cannot successfully overthrow this government.
Well, wait a minute.
Let me
interrupt both of you. It's not a matter of fear. It's a matter of practical politics. There's a number of things that really have to be thought about. The first and most important thing is when the American people, in the greatest numbers, demand change in a variety of ways, legitimate ways, in the street, whatever, that changes the dynamic in enormous ways that we cannot predict. That's number one. That's the tipping point issue. Number two, you have to acknowledge, when you look at the situation, that it is not static, that it's fluid. As the reality of the external situation, the failure of the government to take care of its people at home, the failure of the government to deal with the debt, the failure of the government to deal righteously with other nations, and so on. As these take place, there is an enormous consequence to that. And that's something neither you, Julian, nor I can predict. Right now, objectively, the conditions in the United States are
such that what you're advocating simply has
no validity.
Joe, hold on one second, though. Look at this. Look at the civil rights movement.
Yes.
You know, during the 50s and 60s, black people marched, black people went to jail, black people organized to vote with the threat of death, and actually many, many people disappeared under the conditions, under similar conditions. They were dealing with a tyrannical government, they were dealing with organized vigilante violence, and yet those people faced it courageously and refused to allow the system to continue to operate the way that it was operating.
Now, if you're talking about civil,
they literally confronted the system.
Yes, and you're
and
talking
not
about civil
to operate.
You're
but
talking
we
about
don't do that today. Because
you're talking
the
about
who
civil.
Get out in March are afraid of losing their homes. They're afraid of losing their lives. They don't believe in the principles that they espouse enough to say they're not like Patrick Henry. It's not a matter of give me liberty or give me death. It's I'm going to go out here in March and make a statement and then go home in my Subaru. You know, I'm not going to sacrifice my life for justice. I'm not going to sacrifice my life for liberation, the liberation of my neighbor, let alone somebody across the globe. But I'll certainly talk about it.
I'll certainly pontificate
about it, but I'm not going to put my body on the line.
Well, listen, now you got to pause to allow us to respond,
first of all.
If you want to have a dialogue, it's got to be a dialogue. That's number one.
I'm done. Go ahead and talk.
Okay, look, I remember the frustration that people felt around the Vietnam War and other issues in the 70s. I remember the development of the Weather Underground. I remember the development of the Symbionese Liberation Army. I remember all kinds of craziness. I also remember government repression of those movements on the most harshest terms. Those movements may have played some kind of role, I don't know what, in making some changes take place. But it is absolutely irrelevant to discuss the kind of thing you're talking about until the tipping point is there. And you must raise consciousness at the local and national and international level by all means. All means. Now, if you're talking about civil disobedience as a concept, that's a very different thing. That's not what you're talking about, though. I mean, what you really are talking about is the concept of revolution. This is not a revolutionary situation. Most people
You guys are telling me what I'm saying to you. I didn't mention anything about particular tactics. I'm down with civil disobedience.
You've been talking about tactics. You decried the tactics of the people who went out and marched as self-serving and ineffectual.
I did.
Now, you mentioned the civil rights movement. The reason that movement succeeded is because...
To the degree it succeeded.
To the degree it succeeded was because it was nonviolent. because that basic truth was grasped by everybody in the movement. They knew that if instead of peacefully marching, if instead of peacefully sitting in or peacefully boycotting, had they gone out there and started burning and looting, then everybody in the country would have lost sympathy for their cause and the thing would have failed. If the marchers in Selma had fought back violently against Bull Connor's hoses and police dogs, then the cause would have been lost. And yes, you're right when you say that takes a degree of moral courage, but they understood that to make that a violent revolution would to be to lose any hope of effecting the change that they were trying to effect. And that's the same attitude that underlies the march that went on here in Portland Sunday.
No, actually, it's not the same one. You know why? Because the bottom line is the marchers back then took into account the conditions that existed, okay? They knew that the threat of death was there, and they didn't act violently, but they also didn't allow the system to go on functioning the way it was functioning. They said no to the system. What people are saying in these marches is, you know, my position is that I'm really opposed to this, but they're not putting their bodies on the line. That doesn't mean violence. That doesn't mean picking up Molotov cocktails, but that means Mario Savio, great speaker, UC Berkeley. He said, until you put your body into the machine so that it doesn't work anymore, so that it stops oppressing, you really haven't done anything.
I think you're great. I got to cut you off because we're running out of time. I really appreciate your argument. I think it's an argument that we need to continue a dialogue about and in the future. This, unfortunately, you bring it in late, and unfortunately also, I'm not sure I understand exactly where you're going, because now you're saying you're nonviolent, but while earlier you were talking about storming the White House, it's all quite unclear to me. I do want to thank you for the call, however.
He's saying take it a step further than simply marching to make stuff feel good. I think he's what is that next level? It's probably a general strike.
Well,
it's probably a widespread boycott.
I think before you can have a general strike, and I've had this argument on the air, you have to build the popular sentiment for it.
Yeah,
and that's
the tipping point.
The tipping point has to be reached, and that's what we're working on. And it's hard. It is hard because they control the government, and large extent, although the media is changing, they control the media. But if we keep on keeping on, it's possible. Very possible that this country can create, if not restore, democracy.
All right.
All right.
There you have it.
Y'all keep on keeping on. We'll be with you next week.
Bye-bye.